On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Use and Measurement of Mass Flux and Mass Discharge. Today's training class was developed by the ITRC Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the training over to the ITRC trainers. Today's training is based on an ITRC technology overview document, and we're going to introduce you to the document during today's training, and we do hope that it is a document that you can use after today's training class. Our training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we're getting started. We're scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording today's session. We have over 50 different archives of ITRC training classes, and CLUIN overall has hundreds of archives available. So I do encourage you to visit the CLUIN website to see what training is available. During today's session, trainers control the slides. If you'd like to control your own slides, you can download the presentation, and that's from that CLUIN training page where we started today. We do look for your input throughout today's training. You're welcome to type in a question in the Q&A box. During the question and answer breaks, people on the phone line can also ask questions out loud, and anyone is welcome to send in a question at any time using the Q&A box in the lower right. At the end of the class, we do ask that everyone on the call provide feedback. We really do use the information that you provide. Another option that you have through the feedback is to create a certificate of participation for yourself. Near the end of the feedback form, there's a place for you to check to confirm that you attended. If you check that box, once you hit submit, our system is going to create that certificate for you. So please fill out the feedback, and it's a great way to get a certificate if that's something you're interested in. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. There is more information available on the ITRC website. Now is a great time to go to the website. There's new teams starting in 2017. You can learn how to become more involved in ITRC. On slide 5, I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers are members of the ITRC Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy Team. That team was led by Naji Akladis of the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. Alex McDonald is a senior engineer in the technical support section of the cleanup unit at the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board in Rancho Cordova, California. He primarily works on the cleanup of the Aerojet site in Rancho Cordova and other nearby sites such as McCullen Air Force Base. Dr. Tamsin McBeth is a vice president at CDM Smith in Helena, Montana. She specializes in the development, demonstration, and application of innovative, cost-effective technologies for contaminated groundwater. Dr. Chuck Newell is vice president of GSI Environmental in Houston, Texas. His professional expertise includes site characterization, groundwater modeling, non-aqueous phase liquids, risk assessment, and software development. Alec Noggle is a senior engineering geologist in the Groundwater Protection Division at the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, San Francisco Bay Region. He leads a unit that oversees solvent and petroleum hydrocarbon cleanups at Department of Energy Laboratories and closed military bases. And Grant Carey is unable to join us today, but thanks to Tamsin McBeth for filling in for Grant. I'm now going to turn today's presentation over to Alex McDonald at the California Water Boards. Alex?
Thanks, Juliana. Like most of you, I've been involved in soil and groundwater pollution cleanup projects. And like for the past 32 years I've been working on these projects, I've found that there's always a learning curve on how effectively and efficiently clean up a pollution source. So today, the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy Team, we're going to present to you another tool for your cleanup toolbox. Though this course is being presented to you, mass flux is being presented to you by the DNAPL team, the use of mass flux can be applied to all cleanup sites, not just those associated with DNAPL. These concepts and approaches presented today can also be used in sites polluted by non-VOCs, such as salts, metals, nitrates, and other contaminants. In fact, our office is looking at using mass flux concepts in establishing groundwater monitoring programs at our dairy facilities here in the Central Valley. So what are you going to learn today? This course will provide the basics of mass flux and how mass flux can be used to improve the understanding of the movement of the pollution associated with the site and where to best apply the remedy. You'll see how mass flux can be used to refine decisions and objectives and establish complements to those decisions and objectives that will generally, that in the past we've relied primarily solely on concentration measurements from monitoring wells. While mass flux is not like the silver bullet, it can provide information for improved decision-making and potentially more effective and efficient site remediation. As you can see from the list presented on the slide, we're going to be providing you with everything from the simple, what is mass flux, why is it useful, how do you measure it, to the more complex talks such as regulatory considerations with mass flux. Moving to slide seven, our integrated DNAPL site strategy team is made up of a group of individuals that represent a range of backgrounds, knowledge, and expertise, similar to almost all of the other ITRC teams out there. A significant portion of the team is made up of state regulators, and a majority of the team comes from industry, the folks that have been working with applying mass flux for a little bit longer than we have. Most of the team was part of the development of two previous documents for DNAPL remediation, in situ bioremediation of DNAPL source zones, and a case study document on DNAPL remediation. In those documents, you'll see that the concept of mass flux was introduced, and it became apparent to our team that documents specifically detailing mass flux and use of the mass flux was needed. So the team has also produced two additional documents, one the integrated DNAPL site strategy document, and the one on the bottom of the slide, the integrated DNAPL site characterization document. And all those documents that I've talked about, you go to the itrcwebdocs.org website, and you can download a free copy of those. Moving to slide eight. Why should you use this overview document? This document was crafted primarily to aid state regulators in overseeing remediation of contaminated sites, while also providing information to stakeholders, the regulated community and the consultants. Within this document and summarized in today's presentation, there are sections as depicted on the slide that will guide you in how to apply mass flux concepts in nearly all phases of site remediation, from site characterization to remedy design to establishing a monitoring program and potentially prioritizing between sites, between many sites at one common area in order to optimize resources and address the biggest threats. We are presenting this training in three sections, concepts, measurements and uses of mass flux, regulatory considerations, and then case studies. Let's go to slide nine. Mass flux is not an entirely new concept, but it hasn't been used that much in a formal manner in dealing with cleanup sites in the past. It was used less formally in assessing sites and designing treatment systems, but not establishing cleanup objectives or other similar regulatory measures. This is beginning to change, as seen when mass flux was used a few years ago to establish a cleanup goal in a record of decision at a federal Superfund site in Washington. We will be discussing that site in more detail later in our training. Mass flux, however, has been used extensively in other regulatory programs for quite a while now. As an example, in the regulatory realm of surface water discharges under the NPDES program, mass flux is used to evaluate the impact on surface water and also develop total maximum daily loads for pollutant discharges. Mass flux has not had significant acceptance in many aspects of the cleanup program. This is due to a number of reasons. There's certainly among many members of the regulatory community on how there is, excuse me, there's some uncertainty among many members of the regulatory community on how to relate mass flux with exposure or how to deal with some of the complexity and uncertainty in mass flux measurements. There's also some uncertainty on how to use mass flux in a compliance framework of standard regulatory metrics, such as single point concentration measurements, groundwater monitoring wells. This document discusses, and we would demonstrate in this training, how mass flux can be compatible and usable within the current regulatory framework. Slide 10. As you proceed through the training, we want you to keep in mind questions posed in our first four bullets on this slide. And you'll see this slide again the figure off to the right, you'll see this again and some other slides later on. Those questions are, why should I estimate mass flux and discharge at my site? How is mass flux discharge calculated? The figure on the right-hand side of this slide shows the generic concepts of a mass flux calculation. What are the cost benefits of using mass flux? And can mass flux help measure compliance? The use of mass flux will be expanded upon later in the upcoming, you'll see if you, from this document, go to the Integrated DNEPL Site Strategy document that came out a few years ago. Let's move to slide 11. Near the end of today's presentation, we have several case studies that show how mass flux has been applied at many sites across the country to help remediate sites more effectively. So stay alert through the next excellent presentations for a better understanding of how mass flux can be applied to in a similar way as they did in the slide showing the Reese Air Force Base groundwater contamination plumes as they changed over time, and how using mass flux helped that change occur much quicker than it had been. With that, in my part of this introduction, I will turn the training over to the capable hands of Tad Smith-McBeth of CDM SNEP.
Thanks, Alex. So we're going to go through some basic definitions first. This first section is really mass concepts. And so we want to lay the foundation or the framework in terms of what do we really mean when we say mass flux or mass discharge, and how is that related to the overall context of the subsurface groundwater aquifer systems that we're working in. So I'm going to go through some definitions. First, we're going to answer the question, why do we care? What is mass flux and mass discharge? Why do I care about these metrics? What does it really buy me in terms of managing or implementing a remedy at a site? Our team talked about this a lot, really, in terms of providing the context and why do we really think this is important? Why do we want to develop this guidance document? And it was really the understanding that often point concentrations or measuring concentrations in soil or groundwater, which is the prevalent way that we're managing and assessing sites, has some limitations in terms of overall understanding that could impact how you're making decisions about treatment or remediation or implementing certain actions. We recognized that using some of these new metrics and really understanding things like how is this source and this plume, as shown in the figure, really affecting the receptors, which is this supply well or this river perhaps, what is the most meaningful way for us to really assess that? And in general, a lot of the metrics that are used to assess things like risk are really using mass flux and mass discharge. So it really is linking how the source and the plume are impacting the receptors and using comparable metrics so that we can start looking at these sources and these plumes in terms of, say, overall load of chemical mass into the system. So we know we're already using these metrics. Sometimes we're not recognizing it. A lot of times our groundwater fate and transport models, our risk receptor models are all really using these metrics. And then perhaps back calculating something like concentration. So we're saying let's go ahead and start using these metrics. So what are they? One thing to recognize is that very often, even in the published literature, mass flux and mass discharge are used interchangeably as the same term. But one of the things that we recognized early on is that there is a distinction between the two, and it is actually important to understand if the metric that you're interested in is really mass flux or mass discharge. And so we're going to go through that sort of basic understanding where we've got a source here and we've got a chemical plume emanating from that source. If you draw a line in the sand here, this transect that basically goes across your plume and perpendicular to groundwater flow, what you can do is really look at the chemical mass that's migrating across that plane. And if you're looking at the rate that the chemicals are moving across the plane, then that's actually mass flux. And mass flux is the vector quantity, meaning it has a direction, a three-dimensional direction, and it has a rate. So it's in units of mass per time per area. So it really is this sort of analogous to, say, a velocity term. When we look at mass discharge is basically taking all of those point fluxes, if you break it up into little boxes, and you look at the rates, all the different rates that are moving across that plane, and you integrate those to say, we don't want to just look at rate, we want to look at the total mass of the chemical migrating across this plane per time. So you're integrating this area, that is mass discharge, and that is the scalar quantity here, and it's in units of mass per time. So when we talk about things like chemical loading, you know, that is generally a mass discharge term, not a mass flux term. So we wanted to make that distinction. So as we look at why we would want to look at mass flux and mass discharge, we have a source here, and we've got now these transects migrating or transecting that chemical plume. We've got one close to the source, maybe one mid plume and one down gradient. So in this case, we're looking at first groundwater discharge, which is the amount of groundwater migrating across these planes in terms of a volumetric discharge, so liters per day, gallons per day. And really, mass discharge is just taking that groundwater discharge, that volumetric discharge rate, and multiplying it by the concentration of the chemical. And what that gives you is this mass discharge in milligrams per day. So why would we want to look at mass discharge? One of the things is that, again, as I alluded to, concentration-based approaches don't always give you the kind of information that can help you make decisions about a site. And so this example here, this case A and case B, is really intended to illustrate that. In this case, we have a very large source that's discharging a significant amount of chemical into this plume, and it's impacting this receptor. And so if we look at, you know, this total mass, these concentrations, this receptor, this is our sort of case A. Case B is this much smaller source. It's also discharging chemical that's migrating, and it is also impacting this receptor. So if you were to put a groundwater monitoring well, say right here, you know, in the middle of your plume along the flow path, and you were to measure the concentration of that chemical here, and the same thing, measure that concentration here, the concentration is going to be the same. And so by using a concentration-based approach, it's going to tell you that the source A and source B are the same. They have the same concentration at the mid plume emanating and migrating to that receptor. If we look at this in terms of a mass discharge, or the total amount of chemical mass that's being loaded from that source and that's ultimately reaching the receptor here and impacting the receptor, you can then determine relatively easily that, yeah, our case A, this large source, it's a larger source, it's releasing a lot more chemical, and it's having a much greater impact to the receptor. So in this case, using mass discharge can overall increase your understanding of a site. And when you're trying to make decisions like, do I remediate case A source or case B source, you can start to see that it allows you to do things like prioritize remediation, to look at how those different sources are impacting that receptor, and that can be really useful. So again, here we have mass discharge versus our traditional approaches, where we have these chemical plumes that are migrating and impacting these receptors. In this case, we use these concentrations to evaluate the impact receptor, to quantify things like natural attenuation that's occurring along that plume flow path, and to really, again, look at remedial options, the necessity of remediation and the options for remediation, as well as to quantify what those remedial options are going to buy you. We are advocating that you can use these mass discharge approaches, and we're going to tell you how, all the different methods, and provide case studies that illustrate also evaluating things like impact receptors, natural attenuation, and making remedial option decisions. So our team is not advocating replacing concentration-based approaches for, you know, within our regulatory systems, but really it's an extension and something that should be integrated into your conceptual site models, because very often taking a look at mass discharge can offer a better understanding of your site and the risks to your receptors from those sources. So now we're going to go through the specific calculations to assess mass flux and mass discharge. And first, we're going to go through mass flux, which is, again, our sort of scalar quantity. Again, we have this line in the sand. Here's our cross-sectional area. It's transecting a chemical plume that's migrating essentially out from the plane. And we basically want to take the specific discharge, which is also called the Darcy velocity or the volumetric discharge rate, which is the horizontal hydraulic conductivity, K, multiplied by the gradient, that groundwater gradient. And so that gives you this specific discharge. And that is different than using something like a seepage velocity, which is this specific discharge divided by the effective porosity. So we want this volumetric or specific discharge or Darcy velocity, not the seepage velocity. So that's the first kind of distinction we'll make. Then you take the concentration of the chemical, and in this case you have this transect, you've got this monitoring well, this is the screened interval, so you're really looking at the flux coming through or across that screen, and you just multiply those, that specific discharge times that chemical concentration, and that gives you the mass of the chemical migrating across that transect area per day. So that's mass flux. Now we're going to look at why we might want to evaluate these transects in terms of mass flux. And this is an example where we have a source area, we've got a chemical plume that's migrating, and we have installed some monitoring wells so that we can really look at the chemicals migrating across this transect at these different points that you can see here. Now, one of the more important things that's come out of our improvements to the conceptual site models, and that this mass flux can really help you understand, is that looking at impacts in this dynamic plume system, you need to understand both the chemical concentration, which is shown here by the color of red, so high concentrations in a deep red, low concentrations in the lighter pink or peach colors. And so that's something we all understand. But we also need to understand groundwater flux. We are working in systems that are very heterogeneous. And when you look at the vertical distribution of those geologic sediments, very often what you find is that you have high flow zones where you have a lot of groundwater flux occurring, say within a transmissive sand or gravel, and you also have very low conductivity zones, say silts or clays or compacted sands. So you get this sort of heterogeneous distribution of groundwater flow. And so what happens when we look at that across this transect is that you can have areas where you have very high groundwater flux, so lots of groundwater moving, but low concentrations of chemicals. Or you could be this scenario where you have very high concentrations of chemicals, but very low groundwater flux. So what you want to do is really look at, within this vertical profile, where's the most mass here, high concentrations and high groundwater flux being discharged. And you can really see how understanding that can help you with things like remedial design. We use this to assess, hey, we're going to really target some treatment to these vertical intervals that are really discharging a significant amount of mass. So just to exemplify that further, we have this example where we have a source zone here that's distributed vertically. You've got a Dean apple that's migrated vertically within three geologic or stratigraphic layers of a fine sand, a gravelly sand, and a regular sand. And so when we look at this mass flux term again, horizontal hydraulic conductivity times gradient times concentration, we have about a factor of 33 difference between the conductivities of these three layers. If we keep everything else the same, so we have the same gradient that's applied to each of those three layers, and we have the same concentration, so at this point we're really looking at the sensitivity of the calculation to the conductivity, you can see that 85% of the flux, that chemical flux, is going to occur in this gravelly sand compared to this fine sand or this regular graded sand. So even relatively modest differences in conductivity can have big impacts in terms of how chemicals are migrating through that subsurface system. And to exemplify that further, we have this example that really shows what the systems that we're looking at often look at. So if we have this transect and we're looking sort of into the transect and you've got this chemical plume that's migrating, it's sort of coming at you, if you will. What we have are these, you know, high conductivity or these different sort of stream tubes, if you will, where you've got these different layers where you've got chemicals migrating, and it's really very complex. When we're looking at how do we assess this complexity and model it or understand it in our conceptual site model, one of the things is that scale matters. And the resolution of the samples that you're collecting, here we've got some wells, and we're sampling those wells, say in this case perhaps even some discrete well sampling, so you've got multiple vertical intervals, you're taking those concentrations. What you're seeing is something more like this. So this impacts the resolution, and so we really often struggle with how much data do we need, what's the resolution that we need to affect basically a good understanding or a reasonable understanding of the system so that we can make decisions. And one thing is that we often are taking measurements that are really representing a small fraction of our groundwater plume, say less than 1%. So how can we improve that? How can we make decisions about whether that's sufficient or not? So one of the things that has come about as well within our industry is really sort of understanding that how chemicals are distributed in the environment can be very different when we're looking at, say, early stage releases where you might have, a Dean apple source that's been recently released versus these very late stage sites that are aged. If we're looking at early phases, this is sort of our typical conceptual site model where you might have a residual Dean apple that's emanating through that chemical plume, and this is essentially an expanding plume, but what happens when we start looking at these high-resolution transects and profiles and understanding this stream tube is that the majority of chemical mass is migrating through those high conductivity zones shown in those sort of bright red stream tubes. So that chemical mass is migrating through those high flow zones. That's where your plume is expanding through those high conductivity zones. But what's also happening is because you have a concentration gradient between the high conductivity stream tube and, say, a lower conductivity silt or clay, is that those chemicals are going to diffuse or migrate from these high conductivity stream tubes into the low conductivity zone. So what happens is that that chemical mass offloads as it migrates, and so now you've got a significant amount of mass, not just in those high conductivity zones, but in your low permeability zones. And what happens over time is that, say, 30, 40, 50 years after that original Dean apple release, you have this situation where you have high concentrations still in some parts of that distal part of the plume, but now this original source is depleted. You've had lots of pore volumes of water moving through those high conductivity zones, and those have cleaned out. But now you have all this chemical mass that's stored in your low conductivity zones, and that's migrating back into or back diffusing into those high conductivity zones. And so when we look at why do we have these plumes where we have these persistent low concentrations of chemicals that you just can't seem to affect, very often that's because of this back diffusion phenomenon. And so that's something that very often needs to be accounted for in your conceptual site model. Here we have mass flux and mass discharge. Again, you can use these terms, or they are being used, and they are the basis for things like evaluating source zone depletion and natural attenuation. They're also what we typically use when we're looking at designing ex situ treatment systems like pump and treat systems. We look at capture of the plume, and we look at the discharge of chemicals coming into those systems. And by really just bringing these concepts to the forefront, you can often optimize your systems, and in particular, even your pump and treat systems. One of the things we've been working on a lot is really looking at optimizing those pump and treat systems, understanding where the chemical discharge is occurring into the extraction wells, what vertical intervals that's occurring in, and really being able to optimize those pump and treat systems, lower flow rates to get equivalent capture, but for a lot lower volumetric operational rates. And EPA in this 2012 review actually looked at a lot of their pump and treat systems and determined that because engineers are typically conservative, that a lot of times most of our pump and treat systems are over-designed. They're capturing much greater volumes of water than they need to really manage and control the chemical mass. And so this is one of the ways that we can really often optimize our remediation programs. So in looking at these two metrics, this mass flux and mass discharge, one of the things that our team also recognized is that it does increase some elements of uncertainty. And how do we really manage this uncertainty within our conceptual site models? Because now you're not just managing uncertainty with measuring concentrations, now you have uncertainty with measuring horizontal hydraulic conductivity and uncertainty with measuring gradients. And, you know, we all know, just go talk to your geologist, that very often we look at these vertical variabilities in conductivity, it's orders of magnitude difference. So the long and the short is that really the team recognized that there's always uncertainty. We have significant uncertainty even with concentration data. And so really to use these metrics for compliance purposes or to help us manage our site, we often need to use these adaptive strategies where we recognize that there's inherent uncertainty. But as we're getting new information, we're continually updating those conceptual site models. We're reducing those uncertainties. We're using that to inform things like developing data quality objectives that are specific to reducing that uncertainty that will allow us to hopefully work smarter, be more adaptive, understand that these systems are complex, and through this iterative process as we progress through a remedial program, help us better manage our sites overall. So the long and the short is that there's a lot of advantages to using these metrics. We think they dramatically will improve your conceptual site model. They will help you understand things like attenuation at the site and improve your remedial efficiency, and hopefully help us all understand how long we're going to be managing these sites, what these remediation timeframes actually are, and allow us to manage our sites accordingly. We think we can manage the limitations. It does increase the uncertainty, and it will increase the cost, in, especially in developing a lot of the conceptual site model elements, because you do have to make sure that you're measuring horizontal hydraulic conductivities and gradients, and not just once, but looking at things like, say, seasonal variability, which we often don't do. But by focusing our efforts and bringing those into the conceptual site model, we think we can manage those limitations and overall develop a better, more effective, more sustainable remediation program. And so with that, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Chuck Newell, and he's going to talk about how do we measure mass flux and mass discharge.
Well, great. Well, thanks, Tamsin. Chuck Newell here, and we're really going to maybe go more in the nuts and bolts after Tamsin gave a great explanation about the concepts and sort of how these mass flux, mass discharge works. But what I'm going to talk about is more if you're faced with this problem and you're writing this report and you want to say, at my site, the mass discharge is X grams per day. How do you get that number? How do you do these calculations? How do you do the measurements? And how do you get that number to put into that report? So with that, we've actually, in Section 4 of the document, we have five different methods that you can use. And I'll just go through them real quickly. First, there's the transect method, and that's in Section 4.1. Method 2 is the well capture pumping methods. Method 3, passive flux meters. Method 4, using existing data, isocontour maps. And Section 5 is solute transport models. Now, all these methods are ready to go, and you can use them for for source strength, or you can use them for the plume strength itself, and sort of figure out exactly what the mass discharge would be at these different locations in there. But how do you pick between them? How do you pick between these different methods? Well, fortunately, the team just wanted to provide you some extra insight, perhaps, on how to pick which method to use, and sort of came up with a sort of a tongue-in-cheek method that's based on personality types. And so you, based on your own personality type, there's one method out there that's really perfect for you. And as we identify these methods, we'll go through this and sort of discuss how all that stuff works. So let's go to the first method, and that's this transect method. Okay, so the way this works is we're going to basically do these five steps, characterize the plume a little bit, note where the concentrations are, characterize the flow, and we have some of that. And then the next step is to draw a vertical transect perpendicular to flow, and we always make this whooshing sound we do. You're going to make this vertical transect, and what this does is divides up this plume into different polygons, or what I informally call window panes. And so this is the line in the plan view document. We go into the cross section. In this very simple example, we've got these four wells. The two outside ones are non-detect, but the inside ones do have contamination. And your goal is to define this area where that concentration is represented by a certain area. So this well 3 is represented by the green polygon or window pane, well number 2 by this orange one. And then for each one, you need to know the thickness, the thickness of that unit that has that plume in it, and then the width. And with this, you can start doing these calculations. And so here's, once you have all this information in one place, you then go to the step 4, determine the area, which is that width times that thickness for each window pane, and then multiply and sum them all together. And so here's our mass discharge. Again, units grams per day, as Tamsin talked about. Here's a summation sign, which just means I'm going to have a bunch of polygons. In this example, it's 2, but at some sites you can have 10, 50, 100 polygons. And it's just the concentration of each polygon times its area times its Q, this Darcy velocity. And if you do all this together, you can get this mass discharge of your plume. My plume is X grams per day. Okay, let's look at this Q term just a little more detail in here. And so here is our equation, how they get this Q. That's this Darcy velocity that Tamsin talked about. When the big guy in Dijon, France in 1840s came up with this equation, he just says it's a hydraulic conductivity, some indication of the permeability of the media. We know how to get that from pumping tests or slug tests, things of that nature, or you can estimate it based on soil type, times the hydraulic gradient. And you get that on your potentiometric surface map. What's that slope of that water table or the potentiometric gradient? And with that, you get the Darcy velocity. Now, just two notes down here that we talk about. One is that many of the examples of using calculating mass discharge, we assume just a single Darcy velocity for each one of our window panes to make it simple. You know, the flow is in that unit. But more and more people are using more sophisticated methods where we're using things like hydraulic profiling tools, things of this nature, to get a better sense of what the actual flow is through these different zones. But both ways are okay, and we just say that you can either use one Darcy velocity for each window pane or a bunch of them. The last thing is just, again, Tamsin talked about this, is don't use porosity in this equation. If you divide that term up here by a porosity, you get a seepage velocity, and that's not what we want. Again, when Darcy set this up in 1840, he's thinking about the flow through this cross-section area. Porosity never entered in his mind or any of his equations. And if you think about things like the Tice equation or the Thieme equation, hey, those guys don't have porosity, so you shouldn't use it if you're calculating the flow term in this particular problem. Okay, well, let's keep going a little bit more about the transect method. It's the most commonly used one. We just got a couple of notes here. They can be permanent or temporary installations. You don't need any special well or sampling points. It can be based on larger well screens and multi-level observations. The transects must be perpendicular or close to perpendicular in flow. And that's where this personality type comes from. Who really likes this method? And it's for you out there, people who really enjoy going out into the field. You don't like nothing better than getting on that hard hat, your steel-toed boots, and going out there and collecting that data, seeing all those 40-mil VOA vials in that ice chest filled up with the groundwater, sending them up to FedEx at the airport. This method's for you because you generate a lot of that groundwater sampling data. But you don't need anything special. It's just groundwater sampling on steroids. It's high-resolution sampling to see how this works. Just some other notes, the transect should be perpendicular, close to perpendicular groundwater flow, and you can build these things close to the source if you want to compare before and after remediation, or you can put it out here near the edge of the plume to see how this discharge might affect a potential receptor, you know, at the tip of your plume. Just some other notes, though, we talked about you can do a lot of these different window panes or polygons in there. So here's an example with, well, just a lot of them in there that you can use. And then you just do the same method, you're just going to add all these stuff up. And then the units are grams per day is what most people use. Sometimes people call it kilograms per day. But at the end of this calculation, groundwater flow is coming out of these transects you're looking in here. But you can calculate this. In this particular example, the mass discharge is 488 grams per day, or about 175 kilograms per year, 300 pounds per year. A classification system we developed with some authors from Department of Energy and GSI Environmental came up with a plume classification system, sort of like the Richter scale. And 480 grams per day happens to be a MAG 7 plume out of a 10-point scale in here. So just one other example of how you can use some of this information from, say, a mass discharge study like the transect method. How many points you use, that depends on the use. And here's the table 1.1 in our table. And it just says the different things you might need a relatively low density, like if you're just estimating source strength. But you might need a high density of data points in that transect if you're evaluating heterogeneities and source architecture. So we have different things about estimating plume stability, thinking about remedial action objectives, the picking technologies, estimating the distribution of contaminants. Some of them are high and some of them are low, and this table gives you some insight on which way to go there in terms of designing how many points you need in that transect. You can use multiple transects at sites, and they can be tailored to site conditions and goals, you know, near the source in this example. There's just a bunch in all three units. Then only in this one zone does it extend all the way out to the edge here. So transect 3 is only focused on this because that's the only place this plume is. Then we note you can use this data, mass discharge versus distance, or mass discharge versus time, to get rates. And there's a document that I helped co-write with some EPA co-authors, John Wilson, calculation use of first-order rate constants for M&A, and it says that you can do these calculations with concentration data, but mass discharge data is a lot better, and so good resource for thinking about sites like that. Just some more insights about the transect method, since it's the one most commonly used. You can do pre-characterization, maybe with a MIP, and determine other screening tools, determine where the mass discharge is located. Then you can design your groundwater collection points and flow measurement points to focus on that area where you have that high mass flux. And the last one is site characterization can be different than long-term monitoring. Maybe you do temporary points to really get an idea of what the mass flux looks like, where your high concentration zones are, but then maybe wells that integrate or average this concentration over their entire well screen may be more appropriate for long-term monitoring. So sort of different pieces for this, different ways to think about it for different problems. People are trying to combine some of this high-resolution sampling. Here's an example in our report where Cram and his colleagues sort of combined a CPT rig, a PISA cone rig that gives you an indication on stratigraphy with a MIP, and trying to combine it with visualization packages where you can do slices in different directions and all this nature. Not sure this is getting used a lot, but people are real interested in using some of this high-resolution data from these direct push devices, both looking at flow and concentration and using it to get mass flux and mass discharge. There's some other tools that are out there to help you do these calculations. This is one that my colleague at GSI, Dr. Shella Farhat, wrote, the Mass Flux Toolkit. It's free from ESTCP funded this thing, but you can then use this a spreadsheet tool and you can calculate flux, really mass discharge at this point. So let's look and see how it works. You can, it streamlines this data input process. You can pick an interpolation method for places that you're missing data. It does the calculations. It's got an uncertainty or sensitivity analysis in it. How important is that one point in driving your mass discharge calculation? It gives you graphical input, tells you how to use it. So overall, a tool to help you analyze this mass discharge. This sort of slide here shows that you're going to put all your monitoring points in there. You say, where is it from the edge of your transect in terms of the distance? What's the sampling interval in terms of that screened interval? Where's the plume top and the plume bottom? And what's that concentration point? And this basically builds this complex system of window panes. It interpolates where you don't have points, fills in that missing data, and then in the end you calculate this, and it will then calculate the mass discharge at the very end and say, that's how many grams per day are going past my transect and doing this calculation. So to wrap up on the transect method, you know, it's got some advantages and disadvantages. It's commonly used. There are a lot of applications of it. It's a direct measurement. It's an extension of accepted technology. So you people like groundwater flow, monitoring, taking those samples, this is for you. But that high-resolution data can be costly if you're out there for a long period of time. All those sample points, the calculations can be time-consuming. So those are some of the things to consider in there. Okay, well, let's go to the second method, and this is basically called the well capture or pump test method. And who is this for? It's for you out there who really like pumps, really like putting metal in the ground, and they could be peristaltic pumps, centrifugal pumps, bladder pumps, top drive pumps, Moyno screw pumps, but you like to get that water, you know, pump it up and feel that groundwater pulsing down that tube or that pipe, and moving that water is what you want to do. And this basic approach is somewhat like a cowboy, where you're using your pumps and that well to lasso that plume and bring it up to one place, and that's where you're doing your measurements. Instead of a lot of different flow measurements, a lot of different concentration measurements, you're really just making those two measurements right at the wellhead. What is that flow? What is that average concentration? You multiply them together, bam, you get grams per day in that's coming out of that well. Now, some of the things you've got to be careful of, maybe you don't do this right in the source because that might increase the dissolution of any NAPL that's there. You want to make sure you're at steady state and that you have high confidence that the plume is captured. So you want to make sure that's happening. But a lot of pump and treat systems are really ideal for this. If they're being used for hydraulic containment, you can process that existing data and figure out that grams per day. Here's just a little bit more of information about how this sort of works. You can see the formula here, and here's the units. Say I've got a concentration grams per liter times liters per day. They cancel out grams per day in here, and basically it's that simple. In terms of the simplest application of this, just get your flow rate, your concentration here, multiply them out, and then you get that mass discharge. There are some more sophisticated methods, and these are different methods coming from Mark Goltz of the Air Force and others. Basically using an inverse modeling method where you're looking at this transient data over time from these three wells as you're pumping them, and you can use this basically a backwards groundwater flow model, and that will tell you this what they call total contaminant mass flux, what we call mass discharge from there. So ways to sort of fine-tune this. Doesn't get applied a lot, but certainly those are out there if you want that type of analysis, that extra type of data that's in there. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages? Certainly need fewer wells. It's a better integration of flow and concentration data. You can use existing pumping systems. But the limitations is you don't really see that mass flux data. You're just getting that one number. You don't see where those hot spots are, things of that nature. Large volumes of water you need to dispose of. It's possible to change plume characteristics. And sometimes it's possible to say, have I really captured all that plume? Have I really lassoed everything that's out there to get my number? Okay, well, let's move on to method number three, passive flux meters. And so what personality type is this for? I think it's for you out there who really like new technologies. I mean, you were first in line to get that new iPhone. You don't have a 1983 Datsun out there in your driveway. You have the new car with all the technology, the radar, shark fin antenna, everything else. So new technologies, this is for you. So this is recently developed by Ken Hatfield, Mike Annabelle, University of Florida, and it's a pretty clever device that you put down the well, and it's got a sorbent in it to sorb up your contaminant, and it's got a tracer that leaves this thing. And by using those two numbers, you can get that mass flux in grams per meter squared per day that is flowing through that meter, and you can get a Darcy velocity from this. So here's this picture, time one, time two, time three, when they used it with a dye. You put this down a well, and the key thing is the water flows through this device. And you can see here sort of the dye is being accumulated in this sort of crescent moon type thing. Just think of that being TCE or benzene. And if you have a zone that has a high mass flux, you're going to get a lot of that material through this sorbent here. If it's only a weak part of this plume, there's just going to be this little thin suggestion of that stuff on the very edge. But you put this down into the well, you leave it for a week or two, send it back to the lab, and you get this spreadsheet back that says this is the number that works in there, and you get this mass flux, and you get this groundwater velocity term from Darcy. They have to do some calculations because, you remember, if you have a high permeability lens in groundwater, it converges. So that's part of something that introduces a little bit of uncertainty in this thing. Let's see what they look like in action. Here are the two inventors right here. There's Mike and there's Kent, and they've got the meter going down in here. It's got the water flows through this thing in here, and we've got the devices in there. So there's a company that sells these things, and so this is one way to sort of get these numbers and to get this mass flux type information, you know, at your site. There's been quite a bit of a development through it. They're using it for different contaminants in here. It's been used more at 60 sites. They've sold more than 2,000 of these meters. They're ranging contaminants from naphthalene to ethane, nutrients, and some metals as well. They're trying to adapt this to fractured rock sites. So a lot of development with this clever device of this passive flux meter. Advantages, it's a one-stop shop for flow and concentration, easy to install in the field, you don't generate waste, the vendor can sort of do this for you. Limitations, there were some method-specific issues about lower measurements in push wells, maybe the tracer was biodegrading, and it relies on these well convergence calculations. So the summary of the advantages and disadvantages. Well, let's go to method four, and this is using existing ISO contour data. So who is this for? And this is for people out there who don't like to leave the office. You sort of figured out it never rains in the office. You never get your boots muddy. It's by the kitchen, and there's free peanut butter and jelly in there. But this is if you have an existing plume, and you believe this plume map that's in here. And what you can do is develop synthetic transects where you draw those lines in the sand and artificially construct your own set of polygons and window panes down in here by just looking where does that transect cross these different contour lines. And so what different ways of doing it, there's no one right way, but many times we'll say the edges of the polygons or the actual contours themselves. So here's the 0.1 point, a measurement point. Here's the say milligram per liter contour, and you take the geometric mean of this and put it out in the middle, and that's going to be your concentration represented by that particular polygon or window pane. And so this sort of shows how this is developed all the way through there. Don't leave the office. You just say that I have enough monitoring wells. They're not arrayed in a transect, but I can sort of reconstitute it with these synthetic transects that are in there. Here's a slide that just is more of this sort of detail in here about how we actually are looking at, you know, maybe the edges of the polygon or the actual contours, and we take the geometric mean in the middle. A lot of times groundwater data are log normally distributed, so many times we will use a geometric mean to represent this average concentration between 5 and 10. It's 32 micrograms per liter between 10 and 100. But once you get this thing structured like this, just in your office, then you can go to the Mass Flux Toolkit or whatever and calculate this. Now, some of the advantages and disadvantages of this is that it's pretty easy to do. If you trust that plume map, it will give you that information. The limitations, there was a wide range of opinion about the usefulness of this method. We had very spirited conversations in our group, you know, about how if we should be doing this. And there were some people that says, all groundwater monitoring data are bad. You should only use high-resolution samples. Throw all that old data over. That plume map is not right. But in the end, the group said, no, there is good information in these plume maps. We do have an understanding and can build conceptual models on them, so we're just interpreting those in different ways. So we gave a thumbs up to method four, this ISO contour method. But it is heavily dependent on how good that particular map is right in there. It can be inaccurate if the plume map is built by only a few wells. If you have a gas station site with only 5 wells throughout the entire plume, it's not likely to basically give you a good result. But if you have a sore zone where you have, you know, a ton of different different measurement points, it's gonna work pretty well. Okay, so let's go to the last method in this computer model. So who is this for? This is for you out there who like numbers. I mean, you've got basically a Fitbit, and you sort of know all this material in here. You can tell me what your weight was on August 1st, 2012. You just like a lot of data, a lot of numbers. You've got the most recent computer. But what this method is really talking about is we're going to go in here and use computer models to figure out how to do this. And what a computer model, solute transport model, does is it integrates naturally this flow, and it integrates concentration. That's what it does. So how you use this is you would then take the model, you would calibrate it to your existing data, and then the resulting data from that model, you can get flow and concentration data across the transect, and you can get this mass discharge data. And this is a screenshot from a model that I actually wrote some time ago, 1996, and was called BioScreen. It's still available from the US EPA. And I was developing it, and my friend John Wilson, who was with the EPA at that time, he said, I think you should do what, and at that time we called it mass flux. He said, put a mass flux calculation in there. And I said, John, I'll do it, but why do we want to do that? And he says, at some point people are going to be real interested in this mass flux concept. Oh, man, how prescient is that? So here we are, number of years later, and in the model I have at mass flux, that's really a mass discharge. We became much more precise about our terms in there, but it's milligrams per day in certain transects coming down gradient from the source zone. So this is 256 feet down gradient, 320, and there's the milligrams per day. So that's this idea of how all these different models can do this. They can calculate this together. Let's just go through another example, and this is a great model. It's in some ways superseding some of the work from BioClore and BioScreen. It's called RemClore, written by Dr. Ron Falta at Clemson University. It's a very mass discharge-centric model, and so we've got here three different plots at three different times of output from the model, and the y-axis here, there it is, mass discharge. He's got it in kilograms per year, and then this x-axis is the distance from source in meters. So he had some source that cranked up in 1970. It was slowly attenuating and goes through there. In 2008, this is this mass discharge at certain points going down gradient of the plume. Now, this thing sort of tails out like that, well, because there's natural attenuation going on in that plume, and this TC is being degraded, and so it's smaller in here. But the plume is still out there. So you go into RemClore, and you actually reach your hands and the heart of that dragon and pull out, say, 90% of the mass, and in the simulation it did that in the year 2010, and then you sort of see this mouse going down the belly of a snake kind of thing. Here's that pulse that's still in here. And then by the year 2080, there's still a little bit of that residual plume left from that material that wasn't removed from the remediation. You typically can't get all the mass out, but this is just showing you how this what the mass discharge is of this plume under these different scenarios, in the beginning, sort of during remediation, and then sometime in the far future after. So pretty neat tool. Now, different models can do this, and some of these you can calculate some of the output flow and the concentration to get the mass discharge type numbers or the mass flux charts. But then other ones are have that output in there already. Just note that there's a sort of a new module for the RT3D numerical model called RT-Flux, and Mike Truex said that's pretty neat. RemClore is coming out. And then next year there's going to be another version of RemClore that's actually going to show the matrix diffusion effects. So it's going to be very powerful, but also have this mass flux, mass discharge, really the mass discharge output that that we're interested in at many of these sites. So let's go through the advantages and some of the limitations of the particular model. And we're looking at you don't need a special field study. You can use this existing data, historical data, from existing monitoring system to see, to do these calculations. These models, they're built to combine flow concentration data, so they're natural integrators of this stuff, natural tools to calculate mass flux or mass discharge type data. limitations. You know, it's good to have some experience or training using these models. And then it's the garbage in, garbage out. You need good data, both flow and concentration data, to make sure that's in there. And the amount of data depends on what information is being used out there. And so, for example, do I have an absolute or relative number to do some of this stuff? And table 1.1 in that guide that we showed up can really give you some more indication of some of this information. Okay, well, I think I'm wrapping up. You got five different methods, again, you know, based on your personality type. Are you the one that likes to stay in the office? Are you the one that likes to go out in the field and collect these data? Do you have a new iPhone? So that is just one way to think about the five different methods. Well, we've got the transect method. It's commonly used. It's based on real familiar technology, and we know how to do these groundwater sampling, but it's just really high-resolution, intensive sampling, so we can really get a picture of what that plume looks like and how strong it is. Method two is this well-capture pumping methods. A lot of pump and treat systems are doing this right now, but in some ways your measurement burden goes down, but in some ways you miss part of the picture. You don't really see that architecture of that plume and really what's happening down below when you're standing out there. Next are these passive flux meters. It's a relatively new technology. They're easy to install. It's this one-stop shop. It tells you both this flow, this concentration, and it tells you this mass flux. You can put these in the wells and get several different points where it's measuring this type thing. So the technology that's being used, I think, more and more in terms of its application. Method four, using existing data ISO contours. It's very cost-effective, but you just have to have confidence in that you've got a good monitoring well network, that that data is really going to be good. But it's all based on this existing information that you can use. And then finally, method five is solute transport models. And this combines flow and concentration data. It's helpful to have, experience running these models, but if you can run these things, they're natural integrators of this stuff to combine these and get you that mass flux and that mass discharge information. So I think that wraps it up now. And I think, Juliana, next do we go to some questions and answers?
That's right. Thanks, Chuck. Everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A in the bottom right side. Also, people on the phone line, #6 to unmute, and you're welcome to ask a question out loud. And as we're on this question and answer break, I am going to ask you a question. So Chuck just went through these different methods for measuring mass discharge. And which one are you likely to use? And you're welcome to select all that apply here in the poll. And we have this poll set, so results are being broadcast, and you can see what other people on the training are selecting as their favorite methods. We have a question that came in, and I realize Tamsin has answered it online, but I do want to ask it so we can tell everyone the answer. For the PFM method, is there more than one well required? Where is the tracer added?
So the response is that, so the PFM is really just a tool. It's like a measurement tool. So I think of it the same way that I would think about pulling a normal groundwater sample. You can apply it at a single point in a well. We've been using it a lot in our fractured rock sites where we can put the PFM down the borehole because we're trying to understand where within that borehole we have significant groundwater flux and chemical flux, which fracture, where's the fracture zones within the borehole, and where is the chemical mass, where's that plume within those different fracture zones, and it's worked really well in that application. Or if you're trying to understand what's my total mass discharge, then you might apply it in a more traditional transect approach, like Chuck said, where you have wells oriented perpendicular to groundwater flow and you deploy multiple passive flux meters in those different wells, get the point flux measurements from the flux meters, and then integrate those to get you the total discharge across the plume. So you can basically apply it. The thing I really like about the method, especially in fractured rock, which often your Darcy velocities are really hard to measure in fracture zones, so it can give you some good hydraulic information that's difficult to get otherwise. And I guess the last thing is that when you get the flux meter, you get it sort of ready to be deployed. So all the tracers that are used are already impregnated in the carbon in the flux meter before you get it. And so what you do is you coordinate with them, you tell them the chemicals that you're interested in assessing and give them some basic site information data, and then they sort of mix up a cocktail of tracers specific to your site and your chemicals and your objectives.
And this is Chuck and Tamsin. I'll just add a little bit. Is, you know, they got some nuances in there. If you call up the vendor, they're going to say, what is your rough estimate of the flow is? And they have different tracers that can go onto that, basically onto the material itself. And I think a standard one has got these three different tracers with three different solubilities. But if it's a very slow site, they can sort of change the tracers to account for slow versus fast. But the end is they've got these two things going on with this one device. Is the first is just the sorbent, and it will basically absorb that TCE, that benzene, or that uranium, or whatever you're measuring, and then you get the spreadsheet saying it was X grams per meter squared per day, and that's from the sorbent piece of it. And then seeing how quickly these tracers leave the impregnated material inside the meter, then they'll tell you what that Darcy groundwater flux is.
Thank you. A reminder for our audience, if you do leave before we wrap up today, we still want your feedback, and you can jump to that feedback form in the middle right, the related links, that last item, feedback. To make those links work, you select the name, and then you look down a bit, you select that button, browse to, and those are going to open those links in a new window. We do encourage everyone to fill out the feedback form. One of the things that you can get through the feedback form only at this point is a certificate of participation. So if you are interested in a certificate for today's training, you need to complete the feedback form, check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended, and that is going to generate a certificate for you. And right now, that's the only way those certificates are generated. So be sure to fill out the feedback form. If you forget to check the box, just go back and check it again. Looking at our poll results, it looks like Method 1 and Method 4 are about tied for the most popular methods that people are interested in using, that they are likely to use for measuring mass discharge. We don't have any additional questions right now, so we'll go ahead and continue on with the second half of the training class. If additional questions come in, we will try to ask those at the end of the training. We hope to have time at the end of today's class to answer more questions. So as we go through the second half of today's training, if you have questions, you are welcome to type those in the Q&A pod in the lower right. Continuing on, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Alec Noggle at the California Water Boards.
All right. Thank you, Juliana. Yes, I'm Alec Noggle. I'm with the California Regional Water Quality Control Board. Now, at this point, you've heard Tamsin explain the mass flux, mass discharge concepts, and Chuck has described very nicely the methods. So in the next 13 slides, I'm going to discuss the applications for mass flux and mass discharge. And as you listen, consider your own experience with the regulatory acceptance of these concepts. And then at the end, I'm going to offer some of my thoughts about the regulatory acceptance and experience from my perspective as a regulator. On slide 56, what we on slide 57, when we started this project in 2009, we needed a literature review of how mass flux and mass discharge are being applied. And to help us, Grant Carey of Pure Water Solutions, he conducted a review of 65 case studies that went from between 1995 and 2009. And basically, here's what he found about the uses of mass flux and mass discharge during that time period. Categories 1, 3, and 4 are the most common, the ones you see here on this list. Site characterization, remediation selection and design, and performance monitoring and optimization, the most common uses during that time period. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about those first, and then I'll talk about the other three categories. Category 1, site characterization, using mass discharge and mass flux, has several aspects. For example, it includes determining baseline mass discharge. And that, of course, allows you to quantify any changes due to, say, future remediation that you might do. It also includes providing a baseline for assessing natural attenuation. Now keep in mind that if you measure mass discharge, across two parallel transects using, say, the transect method that Chuck talked about, and this is perpendicular to flow, then the difference in the mass discharge you measure between those two transects, it's a very good estimation of the natural attenuation rate over that area. There is one caveat. It assumes that the rates of sorption, desorption that are going on are in relative equilibrium, but basically that's a really good quantifiable estimate of natural attenuation rate. And finally, site characterization use includes identifying hotspots, hotspot locations where most of the mass is flowing, and rather than just finding the highest concentration, which is what we all tend to do. This helps finding those low and high conductivity zones, and then whether or not you have maybe more than one source, and ultimately targeting your remedial actions. So then using mass flux during site characterization also sets up categories 3 and 4, using it for remediation and performance monitoring. Obviously, you're going to want to target the highest mass flux zones. These are your priority source areas. Measuring the mass discharge and reduction is a great remedial action objective, or could become one. And it complements the simple concentration monitoring that we're all doing. And really, I think the big bang here is it can provide a powerful metric for remediation performance. Now, categories 2, 5, and 6, I've separated those out because they're kind of what we might call emerging uses. Category 2 refers to assessing potential threat to a receptor, such as a surface water body or a water supply well, where there is a plume nearby that may be discharging or is discharging or threatening to discharge to that receptor. And I'll discuss an example of how that might work in a few slides from now. Category 5, compliance monitoring, this is an area where we hope to see more growth. This is about using mass discharge as a regulatory metric for compliance. And one example is to use it as a trigger to change a remedy. I'll talk a little bit more about that later, and then Tamsin, after me, will give an example of that in a case study. And then Category 6 refers to using mass discharge for site prioritization. If you're a consultant, then it can help you prioritize among multiple sources, and to determining the source strength and the threat potential of those sources, which one to go after first. If you're a regulator like me, then you might want to use mass discharge and apply it to many sites and see which one needs the greatest regulatory attention based on the greatest threat. So it's pretty straightforward. On slide 58, now what this slide shows is a rapid increase in the use of mass flux and mass discharge that was based on case study review that Grant Carey did for us. Now, we believe the increase, it's largely due to this desire. The reason why we're doing this webinar, we've been talking about this for several years now, is that desire for better characterization, more effective remedies, better targeting of in-situ remedies. And we are hopeful that this signals a trend resulting in greater use and ultimately greater regulatory acceptance. So I have been talking with Grant Carey over the years about what this chart might look like if it were extended, say, through 2015. He's told me that the bar for the last 5 years, say, if we added one here, would certainly be much taller than what we're seeing. So he's confident that even though we haven't done this, we haven't quantified it yet, that it's just continuing to increase. On slide 59, again, from those case study review that we did, this slide shows how the uses broke down, and you can see that, you know, one difference here is that we've combined in the central bar, we've combined two of the remediation categories, 3 and 4, together. So there's only 5 categories here, whereas I showed you 6 earlier, simply because we combined all remediation aspects into one. And, of course, that takes the cake. There's more use there than anything else, but site characterization is also a growing area where mass discharge is being applied. And again, so for site characterization, it's most commonly to estimate plume natural attenuation rates between the transects, as I mentioned, and determine the extent to which a particular source or site could be contributing. That's also a growing use. This slide just shows you kind of where in the world mass flux and mass discharge are being used. Again, those case studies that we did, this is where they were happening in the world. So we think the good news is that during that time period up through 2009, It shows that there was a lot of interest, and it's worldwide. It bodes well for spreading the familiarity and the acceptance components, which is what we're trying to do, really. And it also supports the idea that it's not necessarily limited to any particular hydrogeologic environment, or at least these hydrogeologic environments are fairly, you know, fairly commonly occurring. So it can be applied in many situations, alluvial environments, bedrock environments, and that's what we think we're seeing. On slide 61, we think the reasons for the rise in mass flux and mass discharge, it really have to do with this desire for more effective remedies and avoiding what I like to call the do-overs, characterization do-overs. The recent experience shows that source zones are often distributed, as shown here in this figure, with very strong cores and steep concentration gradients. They may or may not be very large spatially, but that's kind of what we see. And this is all controlled by the heterogeneity of the subsurface. It makes them hard to characterize using traditional methods such as a monitoring well. So we want to kind of avoid using monitoring wells for characterization and use other more specific discrete methods to figure out what this picture in the subsurface looks like. So it dovetails in with what we might call a higher resolution characterization. Now, at the same time, we now have relatively inexpensive direct push methods, and so we can do these things. And so we are seeing more work plans and pictures coming back that look like this as they characterize the source area. And that helps us set it up for a much more effective mass flux or mass discharge evaluation. Now, another reason, I think, for the increased use is the availability of better models and better databases of past experiences. For example, there is the mass flux toolkit and models such as REMCLOR and BioCLOR that Chuck discussed. Those tools didn't exist that long ago, so we have more tools now that we can use, and that's driving the increased use. There are also decision tools based on the experience from actual case studies. One example is GSI's decision support system that was developed initially in 2005, and then GeoSyntex screening tool from 2012. These provide a way to identify remediation and remediation technologies with the best chance of success, depending on the characteristics of your site. On slide 62, now this chart shows the range of mass discharge estimates that are based on our case study review. 44 sites are represented here. Those are 44 sites that actually had quantifiable mass discharge estimates. Not all of the 65 cases did, but here were 44 of them. And this is what the breakdown is. I think the key point is to give you some context of what you might measure at your site and what people have seen out there in the real world. It's a wide range. This ranges over 8 orders of magnitude from about 1 gram. 1 gram per day per year to 1,000 kilograms per year. So it's quite a range. And then, as Tamsin mentioned, and Chuck at GSI has proposed this plume classification concept back in 2011, and I think it was the Groundwater Journal. The idea is to provide context based on the threat potential for a plume with a given mass discharge. How much threat is this plume if I measure 10 grams a year or 10 kilograms per year? What's the threat potential there? So this is important because most of us don't have a good feel for what that means. We're so attuned to concentrations, and we compare these things in our head to screening levels and drinking water standards, but we don't have similar metrics for mass discharge estimates. So we're trying to get a better feel for what these things mean. So if you want, you can take a look at that 2011 article in the Groundwater Journal and see what is being proposed. Slide 63, here's some more mass discharge estimates. These were compiled by Einarsson and McKay. And again, it's a wide range, a few hundred grams per year to a few hundred kilograms per year. It also shows that mass discharge isn't just for chlorinated solvents, because as you can see here, for at least 4 of these sites are for fuel oxygenates, MTBE. Now, I'll just say further, you know, at my agency, we found over a dozen sites where groundwater extraction systems have yielded good mass discharge estimates, you know, for whatever portion of the plume that groundwater extraction was designed to capture, whether it's for containment or for cleanup. These days, it's more for containment. But we're in the process of compiling those data and comparing the estimates to the area and volume-weighted average concentrations over a source plume to see how these things might relate. We're doing it because we want to get a better understanding of how mass discharge estimates can best be used in conjunction with concentration data. Again, that's kind of the holy grail. How do we use standard concentration data and augment it, what we know about the site, and how we might remediate that site by using extra tools like mass discharge or improved tools. On slide 64, as I mentioned, most of us don't have a good feel for what the magnitude of mass discharge actually means. So this slide shows at least one way to put this into context, and this was developed also by Einerson and McKay. And it helps, and this is an example using a potential impact to a supply well. So the same threat concept that Chuck Newell used in his groundwater journal is sort of enshrined here. What's the threat potential to a receptor? The example shows a source area that is generating a mass discharge of 2 grams per day. That's what you see here. And the extraction well, we've just decided to call it an extraction well. Could be a supply well. I guess it could be a surface water body as well, some discharge point. But in this case example, that's an extraction well, and we're assuming it's pumping at 600 gallons per minute. And it's fully capturing the portion of the plume that is delivering 2 grams per day. So the question is, but it's also capturing a lot of clean water. And the question is, how much of a threat is this plume to this well? Could it cause the extracted groundwater to exceed some standard or discharge limit? And the equation down here is really what you can use to kind of run through that assessment. Again, assuming 600 gallons per minute, 2 grams per day is the mass discharge of the plume. The resulting concentration in the extracted groundwater, when you run this calculation, that's the C sub well term. Let's see, where is that? Yeah, that's this term right here. If you want to calculate that, what you end up with this example is 0.6 micrograms per liter. And it's less than, in this case, that is less than 1 microgram per liter, which is the, which might be the, let's say that's the standard, the drinking water standard or whatever it is. So you can run this calculation and you can get a sense of what might be if you had exact certainty what you might be looking at. And that's the key. You don't have exact certainty, but at least now you have something that puts it into context. So I will say that this is a good assessment for helping you to define a context. But, of course, as a regulator, I need to add a word of caution that there is a lot of uncertainty in mass discharge estimates today, depending also what method was used to calculate that estimate. So given that, this sort of analysis would almost certainly require extra factors of safety in order to get some sort of regulatory buy-in, for example. And I will say, of course, a lot of regulators would probably require any discharge that was a non-zero discharge to a receptor supply well to be mitigated in some form, through reasonable source control efforts, all the way up to total containment. But at least now it creates a way to have a conversation with regulatory agencies about the threat potential of this type of plume near a receptor. On slide 65, so this figure, it's a good way to understand what I mentioned earlier about using mass flux and mass discharge to, say, improve a remedy selection or the design and the performance monitoring. So Tamsin showed you the same figure earlier, but I think in her figure, the concentration was considered uniform over all three layers. Here in this figure, just for an example, we've changed it up. So the concentrations range from 50 micrograms per liter. We're saying that's in the gravelly sand, the most transmissive zone. And all the way up to 5,000 micrograms per liter, which is in the the fine sand, which would be the least permeable zone. So this might be an example of a site where diffusion has caused the contaminant to move over time to diffuse into the fine sand, the lower permeability unit. And now that's, you know, so it's built up in there, that mass is built up, the concentration of pore water is built up, and now it's slowly bleeding out, if you will, into the more transmissive zones as we maybe apply a remedy, say, as this groundwater flows through this zone faster, and it slowly bleeds out. So this is a typical, maybe an old release. The source is stopped, but this is what you have. We call this the back diffusion limited system, perhaps. But knowing this can lead to selecting the optimal technology for your maximum effect. And just imagine if you didn't know this. You know, if you didn't know this distribution, you might set your remediation system in, you know, to target the gravelly sand, the more transmissive zones. We're pretty good at that. We're very good at that, cleaning up transmissive zones. And we might find over time that, gee, it just is, the rebound is continuous, and gradually over time, after lots of money spent, realizing that, gee, we're just not targeting the right area. So it's really important to know this sort of thing. Higher resolution characterization combined with mass flux mass discharge estimation can really help you understand that system. Slide 66. Just want to summarize now what I've told you. There are these six use categories as outlined here. Category one includes the source, evaluating source strength, the effects of natural attenuation, getting a baseline. That's your site characterization uses, and we are seeing mass flux and mass discharge being considered earlier and earlier in the stage, not just at the remediation phase of a system. And this is good news because it provides the baseline and the basis for doing everything else in the future and gives you that comparative baseline. Category two means using mass discharge to evaluate the potential threats to receptors, and I gave the example of how you might calculate that. Categories three and four, excuse me, are about using mass discharge to develop more effective remedies and the monitoring networks and targeting them. Category five is this one about compliance monitoring. So, this is, as I said, one area we're seeing compliance, this mass discharge used as a compliance metric is as an indicator of a remedial effectiveness that can trigger a change, say, from an active remedy, possibly to a passive remedy, possibly to natural attenuation. And we do have some examples of that, and Tamsin's going to give you one in a case study where that was actually accepted by the U.S. EPA as a regulatory metric for that changeover. Category six is this one about site prioritization, which, depending on who you are and what your perspective is, you can use it to prioritize among multiple sites or prioritize among multiple sources at a single site. And that's certainly in our litigious society, I think we're seeing a lot more of that too. It's not my source, it's somebody else's. Well, so mass flux, mass discharge can actually help in that regard. All right, slide 67. In my last two slides, I just want to briefly mention the regulatory precedents and acceptance that I said I would write in the beginning. So I do believe that there's ample precedent for the use of mass discharge in a regulatory context, yet for various reasons, it sort of remains still on the fringes and may be unfamiliar to many regulators. So first, I just want to remind everybody there are examples of regulatory agencies accepting the use of mass discharge as a compliance metric. And the example that Tams is going to talk about is a Superfund site in Tacoma, Washington. It's called the Well 12A Superfund site. Back in 2009, the EPA memorialized the use of mass flux reduction as a trigger to allow them to trigger to a more passive remedy in certain source areas. And in my own experience, about 10 years ago, my agency wrote an order, a cleanup order, that basically told the responsible party to estimate mass discharge and demonstrate how effective the remedy could be for an in-situ bioremediation technology, and whether or not it could, by itself, achieve the the low discharge standards, the low protection standards for a surface water body. So we didn't really know how low the system could get and how much, how much bang for the buck. So we said, use a mass discharge type estimate. It's a large plume, and if you just look at each well individually, the picture is so murky, it's very hard to tell. But if you start looking at the whole thing and targeting areas where mass discharge is higher, you can get a much better picture of what the hole looks like and also where you need to go in and maybe do some, either some enhanced bio or another technology. So we did have that. The difference is the problem is we weren't calling it mass discharge. We were couching it in terms of average concentrations and flow. It was kind of before we really had the terminology, and Chuck mentioned the same thing happening years ago. But that's what it was. So there are these examples. They are out there, and we hope to see more of them. And I want to say something about, in the NPDES world and the TMDL world, these concepts have been applied for, from the start, basically. That's all about figuring out what the mass discharge is to your surface water body from your pipeline or from your source, and allocating, a source loading, a source allocation for that loading. So it's basically looking at that receptor, that potential threat potential to a discharge receptor. So surface water folks are quite familiar with it. Groundwater extraction, as Chuck mentioned, we have a lot of extraction systems. They are capturing plumes. They've been doing this for a long, long time, many years, 20 years or more. It's just that we've never thought of them as providing us with mass discharge estimates. But basically, that's what you've got, is by measuring contaminant concentration in the effluent, multiplying by the extraction rate, you've got your mass discharge estimate for whatever part of the plume you're capturing. And that, so that can tell you something. And that's very useful. And then lastly, as I've mentioned, natural attenuation relies on mass discharge reduction. So you've got a great way to quantifiably estimate it. If you do transex or mass discharge across a couple of locations along your plume or from your source to across the source, you can figure that out. Regulators, when natural attenuation first came out on the scene in the late 90s, it was all about indicators. It was about qualitative indicators. So now we actually have ways to get a much better actual quantifiable estimate. And lastly, I want to close with what are the needs for more regulatory acceptance? So in developing this document and the training, the team had many discussions about what the barriers were to the use of mass flux and mass discharge and how to overcome them. Basically, I feel it boils down to some very basic needs. First is the need to develop more familiarity, a comfort level with the concepts and the estimation methods, and, of course, the uncertainties. That's a big driver. That's why we wrote the document and developed the training. Second, it's the need to understand how mass discharge can relate to risk and risk-based concentration standards. That's what's been enshrined in all of our minds over the decades. It's all about concentration, but it really isn't just all about concentration. It's all about where is the contaminant moving and where is it discharging. So I want to stress that we are advocating this use of mass flux and mass discharge in conjunction with concentration-based standards, not as a replacement. So just as concentration is a good estimate of risk, and mass discharge is really a good estimate of threat. That's the important thing, because when you're talking about supply wells or surface water receptors, that's what it's all about, is what the risk or threat is to that receptor. Concentrations may vary greatly over time and space. Mass discharge can capture the overall effects of that variability. And then lastly, thirdly here, is the need to envision a future compliance role for mass discharge. If I had to bet, I'd say that assessing threats to receptors, developing triggers for remedy transition, this is a growth area. This is where we're going to see most of the use of mass discharge. I also think that basing cleanup success on individual well concentrations alone is an incomplete picture at best. And at worst, it actually incentivizes the whack-a-mole approach of basically just doing something to reduce the concentrations at a given well. that isn't necessarily site cleanup. So there you have it. With that, I've finished my section, and I'm going to turn this over to Tamsin at CDM Smith for some case studies.
Thank you, Alec. So like Alec said, what we're going to do is take all the concepts that we have been talking about, the different methods, the different regulatory contexts, and now provide an overview of some case studies showing how people have implemented mass flux and mass discharge and how they're using these metrics both to manage their sites, make remedial decisions, and how we've used it in a regulatory context. So first, we're going to go through the frequency of method applications. And this is similar to what we presented previously in the 2009 survey, where we were really looking at how frequently are people using these methods, what methods are they using, and so this is again sort of a summary of that same compiled data, and similar to our, our question to everybody, what method do you think you would use, the majority of sites and folks were using the transect method, and that's not surprising, it is more prevalent. A few of the sites were using the integral pumping test methods. A few sites are using passive flux meters, and I have to say, like Chuck alluded to in his portion of the presentation, I would say passive flux meter use has increased exponentially since we started doing this training a few years ago. So that's probably a larger percentage overall of the total. A few folks doing ISO concentration contours, doing sort of an overall mass balance and then modeling. So this is just our survey. I think the proportions of these overall, these methods are getting used a lot more. I'm seeing it all the time now, I would say, in work plans, in it's getting written into more rods. And so people are really starting to use these methods, and we're really seeing a lot of these concepts. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Pacific Northwest National Lab just released a really good overview document on optimizing pump and treat systems, and a lot of the methods that they were advocating in that guidance for optimizing those systems are using these pumping tests and these mass flux, mass discharge approaches. So it's increasing in prevalence. We're going to go through probably one of the first benchmark case studies of using mass flux and mass discharge. And that really is the Einarsson and McKay 2001 paper. And what they were doing is really looking at a chlorinated solvent plume. It was CIS-DCE in this case. And here's the transect. And this is one of the first cases where they really did this very high-resolution sampling where they installed these wells on very tight centers, and then they collected point samples at high resolution vertically to really kind of take a look at this plume architecture, if you will, and to evaluate the mass flux and mass discharge. And so what this showed is a couple of things. One is that this concept of heterogeneity and how the amount or where you're really seeing the concentration profile rather than seeing this nice sort of ISO concentration that graded, we were really seeing these hot spots, if you will, of concentrations. And when we look at the whole plume, 80% of the mass getting discharged out of this transect, that discharge was occurring in 7% of the transect area. And it almost all of it, 90% of it, that discharge was occurring where concentrations were greater than 20,000 micrograms per liter. And so what that was telling us is that often these high concentration and high velocity flow zones are really what drives the majority of the chemical discharge. And if you can identify that in your plume, it can really help optimize how you implement remediation. And I'm going to talk about this concept again in one of the upcoming case studies. So that was pretty useful. This is actually a site we're going to talk about that in this context as well. And this is the Well 12A Superfund site. It's in Tacoma, Washington. And this is a site where the city of Tacoma was operating one of their supply wells and discovered TCE in the well in the early 80s, about 1982. Some subsequent investigations identified the source area as being this former oil recycling facility. So there was, you know, significant amounts of hydrocarbon and chlorinated solvents used. There was all kinds of different tar materials that were deposited across the site, so lots of NAPL, very large source resulting in a groundwater concentration plume. And this site got listed in the early 80s, and a series of operations and remedial actions, including installing a pump and treat system in the source area, doing soil vapor extraction for some vadozone NAPL removal. They installed a treatment system at the city well so that any water that was pumped from the municipal supply well got treated, and doing some excavations of some of the tar materials around the site. Over the course of the operation of the pump and treat system, and as part of the five-year reviews, EPA recognized that although a whole tremendous amount of remedial actions had been conducted, the site was really not significantly progressing towards achieving restoration, which is the ultimate goal, since this is impacting, you know, a municipal supply well. So they implemented a focused feasibility study, and they decided, based on some modeling, to update the conceptual site model, and they were really asking the question, you know, realizing that we're in a very complex site, a very complex glacial till, how can we implement meaningful source treatment, and what kind of performance goals are reasonable based on technologies, realistic expectations for technology performance, and ultimately, you know, making strides towards achieving restoration. And so based on some modeling, they ascertained that the source area was discharging a significant amount of contamination, and by modeling the attenuation of that contamination along the flow path from the source to the supply well, they determined that if they could reduce the mass discharge, that discharge from the source, by 90%, the attenuation capacity of the aquifer was sufficient to reduce those chemical concentrations so that by the time they reached the supply well, they would be less than MCLs. So based on that, an interim ROD was signed that used this 90% reduction in mass discharge as the interim goal for that active source treatment. So that was a really good way to evaluate. And just as a side note for that particular project, we actually used the existing on-site pump and treat system as the method for measuring the mass discharge, which worked really nicely because then not only could we link the reduction in discharge based on attenuation capacity, we could also link shutting down, achieving sufficient source reduction that we could shut the on-site source pump and treat system off. So it sort of linked two things, achieved two objectives by linking that goal, that mass discharge goal, to both activities. Another way that you can use these methods is shown in this case example. And this is actually one that highlights something that Alec was talking about during his presentation, and that's really how can you prioritize, say, treatment if you have a portfolio with a number of different contaminated sites or one site with multiple sources, how do you prioritize which sources to treat first? And mass discharge can do that. And so this is actually a Bauer et al. Paper from 2004 where they were looking at these receptors, these pumping wells here, and they were seeing chemical impacts at these wells, and they had identified three different sources contributing chemical into this plume. So what they did is implement a transect approach and look at the mass discharge emanating from each of these three source areas. And you can see here the size or the load of the sources is significantly different, but when they actually measured or quantified the contaminant discharge coming from those sources, actually the largest source was not contributing the majority of the chemical mass. It was actually this interim source that was contributing the majority of the discharge. And so this really allowed them, you know, where initially just based on size and concentration, you might say, oh, let's go after the biggest source, to really say, no, let's focus our resources and go after the source that's actually contributing the most mass that's impacting this receptor. This is actually a case study that Alex sort of alluded to at the very beginning of this presentation as a way to really look at how you can use mass flux or mass discharge-based decision-making into your conceptual site model. Again, this is at Reese Air Force Base, and this is a site that had a number of different sources, and it had almost a 3-mile-long chlorinated solvent contaminant plume. And this is essentially the conceptual site model in 2004. These isoconcentration contours were just Kriged based on chemical concentrations. So they weren't really looking at geology. They weren't really looking at flow zones. They were just really looking at concentration contours. And they had a number, they had a very large pump and treat system that was, you know, operating at tremendous pumping rates to try to capture and manage this very long chemical plume. So what they decided to do was to go in and look at their conceptual site model, and in particular look at the geology and integrate the geology and the stratigraphy into the conceptual site model, you know, not just, you know, stick the borehole logs in the back of your report. And what they determined is that when they looked at the geology, they actually found that there was, a significant amount of data that was not getting incorporated into the conceptual site model, but two, that they identified a very high conductivity channel that essentially dictated almost the entire chemical flux and discharge that was really present at the core of this plume. So this wasn't your regular sort of dispersed plume. It was being driven by this very high conductivity sand channel. And so what they did is they just said, well, we're going to rework the conceptual site model. We're going to inform the decision-making based on looking at fluxes at all these wells and where we're actually seeing a significant amount of both groundwater flux and chemical flux, and we're going to bound these isoconcentration contours based on those geologic preferential pathways. And what they did is just by reevaluating the data, they basically came up with this presentation of the conceptual site model that really showed more clearly that you had this very discrete channel basically that was driving or dictating the majority of the mass. And so what they did is they optimized just the pumping strategy. They started shutting down extraction wells that might have been pumping a lot of water, but that weren't actually capturing a lot of mass, but they were potentially drawing the plume or affecting the hydraulics of the system in a way that it was actually sort of making the problem worse, right? Because you've got large pumping wells, you're pumping cross gradient, you're drawing mass sideways. So they did is sort of optimize the pumping to facilitate more pumping in the wells along this flow channel, retract this sort of dispersion that had occurred because of their pumping operations previously to draw this plume back into the channel, and really started seeing dramatic increases in the mass removal and the mass removal efficiency of the pump and treat system. So this is a case, and we all talk about pump and treat systems and how they're just containment and they're not treatment, but because of the way this plume is, this is in a very clean sand aquifer, this pump and treat system is actually very effective for remediating or treating the plume. And you can see that within 2 years, of just optimizing their pumping strategy, how much that was affecting the concentrations and retracting that plume. And you can see here now, after 4 years, a dramatic reduction in both the plume extent and concentration, you know, and at this point they can really start to shut some of these things down. So this is really a case study showing and highlighting again how you can use these flux informed decisions or these discharge informed decisions to really optimize operations to make sure that you're accounting for both the groundwater hydraulics, the heterogeneity at the site, and your chemical distribution to optimize the systems that you're working with. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Alex.
Thanks very much, Tamsin. We're going to wrap up this training session by summarizing what Tamsin, Chuck, and Alec have presented to you in our next couple of slides here. So I'll use the next three slides to briefly describe some of the key points. Before we go there, I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge my excellent presenters in this training. I've taken a lot of these ITRC trainings, and by far I find that our trainers, my compatriots here, are the best of the group. In fact, I've listened to this thing for like 6 years now, and obviously I can listen to it and enjoy the whole thing every single time. So they do a marvelous job at presenting the information. I hope you guys appreciated that. Let's go to the next slide. So, some of the key points that they presented. Estimating mass flux provides useful information into evaluation and remediation of polluted sites. By gathering this necessary information and using that information to estimate mass flux and mass discharge, you'll develop an improved site conceptual model. So, if nothing else, just that first bullet, improving conceptual site models, if you can do that, everything flows downhill from there. You, all of a sudden, your everything will improve. Knowledge of the site, where the contamination is found, where I'm best to provide my remediation technologies. So, if using mass flux only gives you the initial improving conceptual site models, you've got a benefit out of doing this. This effort will also provide for a more informed selection of the appropriate remedial technology, and I said, as where to replace that remedy to enhance the efficiency. With improved site conceptual site model benefiting from using the results of mass flux assessment, more effective site management can be realized. As Chuck discussed, gathering mass flux data need not always require extensive additional sampling, as it's often possible to obtain estimation of mass flux using historical data and existing monitoring well networks. Lastly, it can help enhance compliance measurements by providing a better understanding of contaminant movement at the site and helping to guide locating compliance points and establishing compliance metrics. I presented this slide earlier in the training session and told you to keep an eye out and to be able to answer the questions on the left-hand side. We tailored the training to provide answers to these questions, and hopefully you got those answers presented to you properly. In using mass flux and mass discharge, it helps you better characterize the site, assess exposure, and develop appropriate remedial measures. Tams and Chuck provided concepts and five methods to calculate mass flux and mass discharge, even going as far as to say, hey, what's your personality type? And you can be able to pick out an assessment method that will suit that technology type, I mean, your personality type. By calculating mass flux, you can better target the remediation and potentially reduce life cycle cleanup costs. Mass flux can also help measure compliance, particularly if an objective is to have a specific mass reduction metric. Given the time limits of this training session, the information found in the mass flux overview document, we can only really summarize it. So we encourage you to download the document and read it for yourself, and it'll provide a more complete picture of mass flux and mass discharge, and how it could be used to utilized to improve the cleanup process at your site. Lastly here, we have two documents that are out for publication, and also that are available. We have training sessions on both those documents, the DNAPL Site Strategy document in 2011 and the DNAPL Site Characterization document in 2015. Don't let the word DNAPL scare you off. If you don't have DNAPL, both these both the training and the documents can be very useful on your site. Most of the concepts apply to non-DNAPLs as well as DNAPLs. But in addition, we have another document that the team is working on. Most of the team is working on. Some of them have left. But most of the team is working on a site looking at applying all these same concepts into investigating sites that have fractured rock, which is, and that document is due out in 2017. So with that, I encourage you to go to the website, download all these documents, and you help use them to better characterize your site. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to Juliana.
Thanks, Alex. We are going to have time for questions. So anyone is welcome to send questions in the lower right, that Q&A box that allows you to ask questions. If you're in the phone line option audience, the other option is #6 to unmute and just jump in with a question. And while we're at this question and answer break, hopefully answering some questions, I do have a couple more poll questions for you. Would you recommend using the mass flux and mass discharge measurement methods that we've described today? And thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC document? And I have both of those set so that we can broadcast the results and share information with others on the training class. I'll also remind you at this point, we do have links to additional resources, and you can follow the link here on our last slide. These are some of the things we've talked about during today's class. There's also a link where you can download the presentation. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, there's more information available in the notes section of the downloaded version of this presentation. So you are welcome to have that as a reference. I also am asking you to fill out the feedback form. We really do use it, as Alex just mentioned. The team is working on a new training class. We appreciate your feedback to help us not only improve this training, but also we use that feedback to improve new training classes. Much of what we've done has been based on feedback of what people say on training classes. The additional item you get through filling out the feedback is you can create a participation certificate for yourself. Be sure and check the box near the bottom to confirm that you attended today. Once you submit, the system creates that certificate for you. It's available on the next page, the confirmation page. There'll be a view your participation certificate in the blue, similar to what you're seeing here on this slide. Also, if you included your email address, that certificate PDF will be emailed to you. So that's a great way to get a certificate if that's something that's useful for you. And if you have more than one person in your group, you can submit feedback, and then there's a place to go back so that you can submit another feedback form for each person. Do we have any questions to start from the phone line audience? So far, we don't have any coming in through the Q&A, but we do want to wait just for a few more minutes to see if there's someone who is typing in a question and so we can ask that question. Perhaps as we're waiting, can trainers tell us more about that fractured rock team that you all are working on?
Sure. So one of the kind of follow-on documents here, this mass flux we did as part of the integrated DNAPL site strategy document, which went through and really talked about how to build essentially an adaptive management strategy for DNAPL sites, but really it can be used for any complex site, you know, where you essentially have to have an iterative approach and flexibility to, you know, manage a lot of uncertainty because the site's complex. One of the things that came out of that is that we recognized that our conceptual site models were often under-informing our remedial decisions. And so we actually had a follow-on document to really just talk about DNAPL characterization and doing an integrated DNAPL characterization strategy and how to do that and what tools and technologies were really available. There's been so many advances in the industry that allows us to get some of this high-resolution sampling so we can build these transects. We can get high-resolution data cost-effectively, and we can assess things like mass and flux and mass discharge. The cost of doing that has been coming down as these tools and technologies have been advancing. And so we wanted to really bring that out in the guidances, and we developed a really cool Excel spreadsheet tool that allows you to put in parameters about the type of site you have, and then your data quality objectives, and then, you know, it kind of links you to the types of tools or the tools that are available that allow you to collect that data. And so that was, you know, very successful and provided a lot of information, but one of the things that we didn't do is really go into a lot of depth about fractured rock, because of course fractured rock is, you know, the most probably complicated system. When we talk about complex sites, you know, fractured rock sites are on one end of the spectrum. And so now we're actually in process of developing a guidance document that's specific to building a conceptual site model and understanding the characterization tools and technologies and really developing a remedial program for fractured rock sites. And again, it's focused on DNAPLs and DNAPL and fractured rock, but there's a lot of elements of the guidance that can be applied, you know, to any type of complex site.
Thank you. A couple questions have come in. What is the unit cost for a passive flux meter?
This is Chuck. Tamsin, I don't know if you remember, is it a couple thousand dollars, something of that nature, but I think you can get maybe one or two different intervals with it?
Yeah, I think we use about $1,000 a foot. So depending on what your orientation is and how long of an interval you want to evaluate determines the cost and the sampling frequency. So generally, you know, to deploy, say, a flux meter that's, you know, 10 feet in length where you're collecting a measurement every foot or so is roughly $10,000.
And I think that's where you'd put this meter in, and you can sort of put these baffles between them and sort of get multiple measurements from the meter as it goes in there. But maybe on the rough range, it's $1,000 for each number that you would get, something like that.
Right. In general, I think we typically don't like them to be longer than about 3 to 5 feet, just because it gets difficult. So if you do want to evaluate longer intervals, then, like Chuck said, we'll typically string multiple ones together. So you might have, you know, 3 or 4 different flux meters, especially if you're doing long boreholes. You know, that's one of the things we've been using it for a lot, like I said, as fractured rock sites and applying it in boreholes. And if you have, you know, 40 or 50 feet of borehole you're interrogating, then we might string, you know, 3 or 4 flux meters together.
Right. And then I'm actually doing an online search of my email. So here was a quote we got from the vendor, and I think there were 2 5-foot meters, and we were getting 2 measurements for each meter. And so that's a total of 4 samples, basically, 4 numbers, and that cost to get the meter out there and then for them to do the analysis, $5,000. So a little bit over $1,000 for each number.
Thank you. We are out of questions, and so we'll go ahead and wrap up a little bit early on today's class. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you do have questions that we didn't get to or more occur to you, you can email those to training@itrcweb.org. We have a web page where you can post those questions and ask trainers to follow up after the class. If you haven't already, please fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide, and it's your chance to create a certificate for attending today's training class. More information about ITRC is on the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org.